recording. Okay.
Great. Good afternoon. This is Yannikin Smucker. I'm here with Joe Cunningham, who has graciously agreed to be interviewed as part of Quilters Save Our Stories. Today is August 18th. And we are in Joe's studio in San Francisco, California. Thanks so much agreeing to meet with me today. I'm really happy to have met you this weekend, and I look forward to getting to know you better. We're going to start our conversation today by talking about one of the quilts here in your studio. Do you have one that you would like to talk about in particular?
I think the blue and white one.
Okay.
It represents a lot of things that that I'm all about. For one, it's nice to sleep under. It's a blanket. For another, it's a classic pattern. I get all of my ideas from quilts. I get really nervous when I'm not making a quilt. When I'm making a quilt, I don't get nervous at all. I feel like, oh, well, I know how to do this. It's the one thing I know how to do, you know, is to make a quilt. So, like when I make something like this quilt over here, should I do this? Should I do that? What do other people think about it? I have these endless insecurities. But making a quilt like the blue and white one, I don't have those kind of insecurities. This was made in 2001. It's a six-year-old quilt now. And I made it for my musical about Joe Headley, Joe the Quilter from England, who lived 200 years ago. And so I made six quilts to tell the story of his quilt-making career. And I tell the story of his life and then sing songs that I wrote about him. So this quilt is a classic design, Tree Everlasting, it's called, or other things, you know. It's just sawtooth-edged bars that I wanted to know what would it be like if I just used scissors and cut everything freehand. Because you know a lot of old quilts were made that way. That you'll see quilts, you've seen quilts that are, you wonder what kind of template was she using anyway. The template she was using was no template, I think, sometimes. So what would it be like to just cut? Well, see the top row there? It's disappointingly easy to do, it turns out. I wanted a wilder effect, you know? So I start out in the top row just cutting, my eye is good enough at this point. I could just cut triangles and they all fit and everything was easy. That's not the effect I wanted. So then I started deliberately messing things up and using scraps to sew together so that I could finally get wildness like I did eventually. As you can see, as the bars go down. Then I evened it all up because I have enough of the quilt maker in me, or the, the prissiness or something in me from learning from old ladies how to make quilts that I want it to be square and flat. So I evened it all up, added borders, and then quilted it freehand. And so since I quilted it freehand, let me see. So I quilted in the letters down the white lines there. Mm-hmm. Joe Headley's first quilt, it says, made by Joe Cunningham. In the next bar, in the next white bar, it says blue and white, 2001. And then on the bottom, it's just a kind of a vine with leaves with background quilting. In the blue print there, there's fancy designs. It's around the outside border, there's this sort of a sunrise, then a half of a feather wreath, and then a swag with this it's this very fancy design. Then down the blue and white bars, the blue bars there, it's a spiral that goes into a fleur-de-lis.
Oh, I see it.
See that?
Yep.
A spiral into the fleur-de-lis. And then here, there's the swag. Here's the little bit of a feather wreath. There's this kind of a sunrise. It's very complex. And I quilted it all freehand. And when I got it done, you couldn't see it at all. Right? It took me months. I mean, it was not months of quilting. As you know, it doesn't take that long. For me, it takes about 12 days, 12 working days to quilt a quilt, right? A six-foot square quilt. But it took me months to get those 12 working days in. So it was months working on it. And then when I got it done, there I am with something that you can't even see the hand quilting in it, which is one of my favorite things, actually. Because a woman gave me a quilt one time. It was a Pennsylvania German quilt. Mary Silber, the great quilt collector. It was a crib quilt. Pennsylvania German. The bars were about 3.5 or 4 inches wide. And I'm trying to remember, were they pink and yellow or red and yellow? You know, that kind of... it was the Ely and Walker print, the tiny little calico print that was in print for 150, 130 years, whatever it was. So, you know, it was made sometime near the turn of the century, a little bit before, probably 1890 or so. It was so boring. It was just these strips. You couldn't even... there was nothing there. But it was nice, and she gave it to me. And so thank you very much. One day in my studio, it was lying in a certain way. And when the sun raked across it, all of a sudden I could see that in this bar were cables. In this bar were feather wreaths. Cables, feather wreaths. But you couldn't see. They were invisible in there. Well, that's somebody that likes to quilt. And I like to quilt. And quilting, hand quilting, the one element of its decline has been how people view it. They view it as this enormous barrier between their finished piece, that all the effort goes into the top, you know, it's surface design. We're artists, we're making this design, we're making this artistic statement. And once the top is done, the artistic statement is over, man. They've done it. They've said everything they have to say, but they still have to quilt it. You know what I mean? So they still have to quilt it. So either they will. What used to happen is they would quilt it perfunctorily. Mm-hmm. They would quilt it, and you could see they didn't enjoy that, did they? They were too hot at it, and they didn't really like it. And they got it over with as soon as possible by keeping the lines far apart and all of that. Quilting in the ditch. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of that stuff. So, which is hard. It's yucky to quilt in the ditch, you know?
I agree.
Who needs that, you know? But they're so ashamed of their quilting. Ugh, forget it. Anyway. So, therefore, when machine quilting came along, people were primed for it. The women of this revival were primed for it because quilting had become just a chore. There was no joy in it. There was no artistic value in it. It's just a functional thing. You have to make it a quilt by sewing the three layers together. And the last thing that people will say many things about hand quilting, but the last thing that they'll say is how great it is and how renewing it is and how rewarding it is. And as you know from being a quilter, when you have made this object and you have quilted it, when you sit down at the frame and it's an ocean of fabric in front of you, it's the most unrealistic thing in the world to think that you're going to quilt that. You're right?
Uh-huh.
How are you going to do it? You do it a stitch at a time. You can't. It's stupid. There's no way you're ever going to get it done, it just looks like. It's so intimidating. And then you start quilting, and then it's 6 hours have gone, and you don't know where they went, except you do. They're all right there. And furthermore, if you quilt on an old-fashioned frame so that you roll it up mm-hmm. as you go, it's really great psychologically because your finished stuff gets rolled up and rolled up and rolled up and rolled up. So by the time you have it done when you're, however you do it, but it's going to be 12 or 14 inches
mm-hmm.
down the middle is all that's left that's visible. You take that last stitch in there, and then you unclamp and you unroll, right? and cut that sucker out of the frame or unpin it, however you do it. And you get to see what you did for the first time. Whereas, and it's great. It's really, oh, what a feeling. Hang it up and get a glass of wine, you know. Or it's what you feel like. Whereas, if you quilt in a hoop, you have the whole thing dragging around. The whole thing is looking at you all the time, saying, apparently done. I don't know. It's just, and there's no big deal when you get it done. It does. It's no different than when you first started. Looks wise, I mean, you got it done, and that's good. Okay, it's good. You got it done, and you can hang it up now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you don't get that because when I finish, I work spontaneously. I don't make drawings, and I don't do it on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
So I work spontaneously, and I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, I don't know what it's going to look like until I'm done making the top. And then I go, oh, that's what that idea looked like. Okay, this time, you know.
Uh-huh.
Okay, great. So then I put it in the frame, and then I quilt it. Lots of times, because it takes me so darn long to get something quilted nowadays, months, I don't remember what it looked like. Not really, you know, because I only saw it for a little while,
uh-huh.
and then I quilted it down. And so that it's a moment of glory for me, of existential glory, to pull a quilt out of the frame. So if you cannot see the quilting, guess what? Who cares?
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? I know it's there. I can find it.
Uh-huh.
You know, if we crawl around on our hands and knees when it's on the floor, you walk right up to it in a show, and you can see, oh, yeah. Because quilting, the other aspect of it is, to me, is that quilting is so precious. It's so, I mean, if you're going to do hand quilting, if you go to the show where there's 300 quilts hung up in the big auditorium or convention center,
mm-hmm.
If you are going to hand quilt it, well, by God, those stitches had better be perfect, and they'd better be, you know, they'd better meet at right angles, and by God, they'd better be close, and they'd better be, because you're hand quilting it, and you've got to put a lot of hand quilting, and it's so precious,
uh-huh.
because it's just not done, and so you have to do all this stuff. Well, I just hate the idea of making hand quilting so precious. I love to quilt, and it's part of my life. I'm a quilter, you know. And so the idea that it's so precious, then that engenders, that fosters all kinds of unhelpful thinking, I believe.
Uh-huh.
If it's so precious, then, like I say, you better not make any mistakes. And so when I teach hand quilting, I'll get these expert hand quilters in there whose stitches are much finer than mine, you know, often in my classes.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're trying to do is perfect their stitches.
Hmm.
And they want to know, so, you know, at the corner of the block, what do you do? You know, you've got the
uh-huh.
seams.
Uh-huh.
What are you going to do about the seams? Well, I avoid them if I can. If there's any way I can, I avoid them. Well, what if you do something where you can't avoid them? Well, my stitches get bigger, you know? And as you can see how it ruins the quilt? See over there how it ruins the quilt
uh-huh.
because my stitches got bigger? You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, and I think there's a lot of things that foster that kind of thinking. One is the competitions, because judges will actually say that stuff on their forms that, you know, the stitches spread out in the corners. And you get marked down for that. And so in a way, the people are right who say that, who think that, you know what
uh-huh.
I mean, who are worried about it. They're right. If they're entering contests, they're going to get marked down if there's the slightest. So I think contests foster a lot of it. But also, it's just the general overall preciousness of hand quilting. People then feel like it's life and death. It's life and death. It's the furthest thing from an ordinary part of my life. It's this Everything is coming to the whole tradition is coming down on me right here in my frame or my hoop or however I'm doing it, and everything has got to be perfect. And so, you know, what if there's, what if you draw a feather wreath and there's one fewer feather on this wreath than there is on that wreath, you know? How can I make these feathers line up? Well, they can't line up because it's a curve. There's going to be more feathers on the outside than on these. What do you mean they can't line up? They have to line up. Well, no, they don't. If you line them up, it's not a feather design. It's something else.
Uh-huh.
You know, the tension of it all. And so I like anything that militates against the tension in quilts and the overall.
Uh-huh.
But specifically, that's why I wanted to talk about this blue and white quilt, is I like the idea. This was a conceptual thing. I wondered, what would it look like to make a traditional pattern? I'd like to make a lot of traditional patterns freehand. What would that look like?
Mm-hmm.
What would it look like to do a two-color quilt without any, you know, without a plan? Okay, so here we go. This is what it looks like. Well, guess what, Yannickin? It's not the greatest quilt ever made. It's cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like it, you know. I like
as
it a
do
lot.
I.
But it's not the greatest quilt that ever walked, you know. I mean, there it is. It's a two-color quilt. Two-color quilts don't set me on fire in the first place, generally. You know, they got to be really unusual, like that chicken the other night.
Oh, yeah.
Which did have a third color, but still, oh, my goodness. They got to be really something.
Uh-huh.
And this one, it is what it is. Well, good. I accomplished what I set out to accomplish, which was to find out what it would look like, right?
Uh-huh.
I found out. It looks like that. Well, great. And it and in my show that I made it for, it has a function, and it's very valuable and everything. But if it's not the most successful quilt, if you can't see the quilting, you know, well, they're not all going to be your first quilt, your best, your greatest quilt you ever made. And so, I believe that there's something about this revival has made many people feel, I don't know, that their reputation is at stake or something. I mean, it seems to me that 19th century quilt makers felt empowered to make quilts their own way. They were doing something so fundamentally different than what we're doing that it's hard to discern, but and it's hard to define. But they were doing something, I believe, fundamentally different. For instance, there was a great deal of randomness with 19th century quilts. The women would be making piece quilts. They would work along until they ran out of that fabric,
mm-hmm.
and then they would start in with a new fabric. Well, that tells me that they had a wholly different idea of what they were trying to do. You know, women today, when they're making quilts, if they run out of, well, they wouldn't run out. You plan ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You got your software telling you how much yardage to get, right? But if you were making the blocks and you ran out, then you'd have to do something clever. Then, I'll use another brown and I'll put it in the corners.
Uh-huh.
I'll arrange it symmetrically,
right.
Or I'll put those in the middle to do the one composition that everybody knows, which is it's like an exploding sun or something from the middle, you know?
Uh-huh.
We have an area of lightness that then goes. So we'll do something like that with these with it. But in any event, we have to indicate that it looked intentional. We must control every aspect of this process. We have to look like, I mean, we're artists. You can't just let things happen. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
We're 19th century quilt makers. Just let things happen. A lot, man. They cut borders off. The border design is going along until they're done with it, and then they cut it off. You know, you reach the end of the border. Well, now you have to resolve the corners, right?
Right.
And all this stuff, you have to control every aspect of it. And 19th century quilt makers, it seems to me, there was many things that they left to chance. lots of the great appliqué quilts, the majority of great appliqué quilts, their abilities to replicate curves, exact mm-hmm. curves. How about the handles of baskets?
Uh-huh.
Talk about the handles
yeah.
of baskets. So that if you see a basket quilt from the 19th century, every handle will be different, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's because they were doing something fundamentally different. They were putting handles on the baskets, right?
Uh-huh.
Quilters now are making a pattern. And you got to, you know, and so you have the template and every single handle is exactly the same. Stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm, so because otherwise, if you just put handles on the baskets, it would look like what? Like you didn't control it. And the suggestion then, I believe, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but the suggestion then is that you didn't know how to control it. And there's a lot of angst around your ability to control your process. You know, you want the quilt to lay flat. You want the quilt, you want the stitches aligned and everything's symmetrical and you turn the corners evenly and, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So I'm always trying to do things that I don't control.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to lose control.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to shed control. So when I do lectures, it's the same thing. I want to provoke myself to use whatever happens in the room
mm-hmm.
to make it now, to keep dragging myself into the now, and not into my outline.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm making quilts, I keep trying to drag myself into the now. I don't want to know if I, in the past, when I've made commissioned works, and I would draw them on the computer
mm-hmm.
or by hand and make a tissue overlay for the quilting designs
mm-hmm.
and everything, and then I start making the quilt once I get my down payment, and we're doing the, and it's all official for the designer or the architect or whatever, and I start work on it, I've already done I have already had all the fun.
Mm.
And all that's left to do now is the work.
Uh-huh.
I've done all the creativity.
Uh-huh.
I solved all the problems. And now I just have to do the work. And there's a certain journeyman's joy in doing something that you know how to do. It's a good thing. It's just to do a job that you've worked a long time at and you can do it. And there's a certain amount of that. But I don't have to do that anymore, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I'm doing. That's not what I want to do. So I keep trying to come up with ideas. Well, what would it look like if? And so then my quilts are then an answer to that. It would look like they end up saying like this.
Uh-huh.
That's the message of my quilts, like this.
There it is. Yeah, that's great. So how did you begin quilt making?
I started making quilts. Let me check this and make sure there's. Is there some way for it to tell me? Oh God, a 23-minute answer.
That's all right. That's all right. I'm happy not to be talking.
All right. I was back in my hometown, Flint, for the summer after my 1 year of college in Colorado. I was going to go back to college that fall. I went home to work on an album as a guitar player with a friend of mine and to write the lyrics on this album. And I was there that summer, and a friend of mine said, you should... he told somebody else. He told this woman, folk singer, you should hire this guy to play guitar with you on some concerts. And her name was Gwen Marston. And so Gwen called me up, and I went over to her house for rehearsals for a series of concerts she was doing. At her house were these boxes full of blankets. They were blankets. They were old. It turned out they were the quilts of Mary Schaefer, who just died this winter. She had gotten a grant to document Mary's collection and to produce a catalog. She had a bunch of boxes of quilts at her house, about a third of the collection, for the photographer to take pictures of. And I wanted to look at them. So she showed me a bunch of the quilts. Well, something happened to me, you know. I loved them. She made quilts. She had learned how to make quilts from a Mennonite quilting group in Oregon when she had been there on a sabbatical once. And so she was making quilts for her kids and what have you. But just working along as a quilt maker. Well, but she had discovered Mary Schaefer, who was this great quilt maker in mid-Michigan at the time. She was born in 1910. This was in 1979, so she was 69 years old. What I wanted to be was a writer. So, and I had just finished my 1 year of college studying English primarily. And Gwen told me at one point that she was doing the documentation for this. She loved getting all the information together, but she was dreading writing the catalog because she didn't feel like a writer and she didn't want to become one just to do. I did study English for a year. I could do almost anything really with the English language. You know what I mean? I was 26, and so I said, well, I could write that for you. Well, you'd have to know something about quilts. And I had heard a phrase that I loved in school, which was all the available literature. I loved that. And I thought to myself, well, I know something about quilts. How about if I read all the available literature? How would that be? Which at the time, this is 1979, there was about 8 or 10 books, you know.
You could read all the available literature.
Took me most of the summer to read, you know, Finley and Dr. Dunton, Marie Webster, Florence Pito. There was just not that many. These women all then became my heroes. And then Barbara Brackman's stuff in Quilter's Newsletter. And so I just read everything that I could read. Then I met Mary herself. And, well, Mary was thrilled. Here was this young man that was interested in quilts, you know. And one night, Gwen came over to my apartment with a little crib quilt. It was a drunkard's path and a big thimble that she had found someplace and said, if you're going to write persuasively about quilts, you need to know how to quilt. So here's how it's done. Rocking stitch, she taught me. And all right. I was already becoming very interested in her, you know. So fine, you know. I thought, this make a good impression. So by the time I finished that quilt about a week later, my stitches were good enough that I could sit at her frame and quilt on her stuff. And then I wrote the catalog, and we put up this big Mary Schaefer quilt show that year, to which an editor came from a now-defunct magazine. Her name was Carter Houck, from the it was called Ladies' Circle Patchwork Quilts magazine. And Carter was doing a story on Michigan quilts. She asked me if I would write an article about Mary Schaefer. Well, I wanted to be a writer, you know, getting paid to do an article about Mary Schaefer, who I already had all the material. I'd already written, you know. Well, sure, I'll do that. We went around, and I started seeing what other people were doing in quilts. And it seemed to me that, even I was so arrogant, but it seemed to me that people's take on quilts was fundamentally unserious. That there was something. They're too serious, and now I want them to be less serious. I'm serious about this, my life, you know. And they would call people would call themselves traditional, meaning what they do is make all symmetrical. I use time honored blocks, and I use. Easily blended colors, and I arrange them symmetrically with a border. That's what they meant by traditional. When the traditional will put hair on your toenails, the traditional is wild. It's this realm of wildness. You know, if you really look at what's in the tradition, and it always seemed insulting to me. And I thought, well, I could do better than that. You know. Come on. And so I wanted to make a quilt. So then we worked together on a quilt and sold it for like $1,500, the first quilt that we ever made together, you know. And then one night, on the way to a gig, I was playing, Gwen was going with me in Ann Arbor, and I said, I know what to do. I got this like thunderbolt of inspiration. I realized many years later that it was, I think, partly inspired by reading the story of Joe Headley, Joe the quilter from England, a man who was a professional quilt maker. But anyway, I said, let's go pro. Let's get some business cards printed up that say professional quilt makers. And when we meet people, let's tell them we're professional quilt makers. You know, what are they going to say? Like, where'd you go to school? Where's your license or something? You know, I mean, what they can't prove that you're not a professional quilt maker. And then people started hiring us. The Antique Club then in town heard there was these professional quilt makers, and they would come and give a talk. So go get paid $50 to talk about the history of quilts, which that's all I was talking about anyway. And we were also performers. And so getting up and doing a lecture, well, this is a piece of cake, you know. It's easy. Whereas at the time, this is late 79, early 80 when we were getting started, 80, 81. Most of the people who were doing quilt lectures were not performers. Mm-hmm. They were women who had become very good at quilts. Mm-hmm. And it's two different things, you know. And so many of the great, the early great quilt authorities that I saw were reading their lectures from an outline. And they were not that comfortable doing it, you know. And so, and I was 26, you know, 27. It was so, I was this very tall guy. And I mean, it was very easy to stand out. It was very easy to get a lot of attention. Plus, we worked like crazy. Gwen's kids were in college then. And so we had no children to contend with. So we could just spend all day making quilts. Lots of times had to play gigs at night, but we just quilted all day, you know. And so we could produce a lot of quilts, quilt one at least every month, and sometimes more than that. And so we had a lot of hand quilting done in a hurry, and it was very impressive. And then we started writing. We've got a book contract for Dover right away, and then AQS, and we wrote a bunch of books together, and then eventually got a column for Lady Circle Patchwork Quilts, and wrote for them how to make quilts. So we eventually built a house on an island in Northern Lake Michigan, and had the upper part of it was a quilt studio, and we moved up there and started the Beaver Island Quilt Retreat, which still goes on, and although not on the island, it's someplace else now. And made quilts and traveled around the country and wrote books and made videos and all of that sort of stuff all through the 80s. And then we finally split up, and I moved to New York City in at the end of 91, early 1992. And I went back to music for a while and was a music director for a theater company. And then I got a radio show in Vermont through a crazy series of things. And I worked with a theater company up there. And then eventually I was hired by Julie Silber, who was then the curator of the Esprit Clothing Company quilt collection, to come out here because she was starting her exhibition business, the Quilt Complex, and needed a writer, a quilt writer, who knew Amish quilts, to write all of her materials. So I came out here for a 5-month job, and then met Carol and got married and stayed. So I've been here ever since. So that's how I got started.
That's great. Okay, that's. I'm glad you brought in the piece with Julie Silber, because that's how I became familiar with you. Is I read your essay in the catalog for the Brown Collection.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And that was when I first saw your name, and I was really struck by that essay, because I was starting to study Amish quilts at that point, and saw the exhibition, and So, did you do a variety of things with Julie and the quilt complex?
Yeah, I mean, when Gwen and I started, let me just reiterate here, it was 1979.
Yeah, much earlier.
And to see Amish quilts, I went to see the show. It was the Holstein collection and Vanderhoof collection at the Detroit Institute of Arts.
Okay.
Mary and Gwen and I went. Uh-huh. So there we are. Well, Mary goes up to the Sawtooth Center Diamond.
Uh-huh.
And she's got her little cloth tape, you know,
uh-huh.
and she's away. She knows not to touch quilts, but she's away from it like this. And so she's measuring. Those are 1.5 inches on a side, you know. Well, I'm there taking notes, and the guard comes over and says, "What are you doing?" "I'm making a sketch." "No sketching." "No sketching? No, there's no sketching, no photography, no drawings."
Wow.
Okay. So one of us would stay out in the hall,
uh-huh.
and the other one would go in and looks like about 6 inches, and then go back out and tell uh-huh. the person it's 6 inches. You know. So that was the first Amish quilts I saw uh-huh. in real life. But for the majority of Amish quilts that we, Gwen and I went through a phase when we first started, I wanted to be serious.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, of course.
And Amish, of course. And Amish quilts. You can't be any more serious than Lancaster County Amish quilts. So... I'm wanting to make these copies of center diamonds and center squares and stuff. So where could you see them? Well, the Julie, I knew a little bit, and she, I mean, I met Julie, and she sent me pictures of quilts.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Gallery of Amish Quilts came out then by Bishop and mm-hmm. Safanda, and was it Phyllis Hadders mm-hmm. had a book on Amish quilts then? And so we copied a bunch. Mm-hmm. We copied about 25 Amish quilts, you know. Well, we're making them out of cotton.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot mm-hmm. by trying to copy the quilting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met some Amish quilters. And mm-hmm. So I was just totally into Amish. I had copied these quilts and meticulously copied the colors. When I came out here and saw the quilts that I had been copying, they were completely different.
Uh-huh.
They were completely different in every particular. The colors were not right. The
uh-huh.
proportions were off.
Uh-huh.
I'd copied them very closely, but they were off, man.
Uh-huh.
And then the quilting designs, which I was so good at copying, were embarrassingly more sophisticated and better done. And oh, it was embarrassing to see. Oh, I thought I was making these beautiful things. I was making these pale imitations, these ugly. I mean, they were not ugly, but they were imitations. When I saw the real thing.
Right.
And was able to handle them a lot. And so ever since then, 1990, I saw them when I came out in the 80s,
uh-huh.
during the glory days of the Amish quilt collection
right,
there at
right.
Esprit. But ever since I moved out here to help with Julie, I'm the one that handles those quilts.
Okay.
So I'm the one that packed them up to send them to Lancaster when he finally uh-huh. sold them back. And so I've lived with these quilts, and I've breathed their dust, and I just love these quilts.
Uh-huh.
And if I were to set out to make an Amish quilt today, I think I could do it a lot better than uh-huh. the ones that I used to make.
Much more intimately acquainted now.
Yeah, yeah.
Those 25 or so quilts that you were making painstakingly studying, what happened to those?
Well, when Gwen and I split up, she got all the quilts that we had made.
So those weren't ones you had made?
We
sell or on commission?
A lot of them got sold.
Okay.
Let me see here. This is not a copy. This is just an Amish-style
mm-hmm.
log cabin. It got sold. There, you know. This, it got sold. They got sold. They I don't know. Is the
mm-hmm.
other answer.
Right.
I got 10 quilts when we split up, and I only have a couple of those left.
Uh-huh.
I've sold them.
What is the name of that book? Sets and Borders
by
Gwen Marston and Joe Cunningham.
Uh-huh. Copy.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
It's a pretty good copy.
It's pretty good. Until you see the real thing.
Uh-huh, of course.
And see how... And, but then, of course, this photograph doesn't really represent that quilt either. So now we're You know what I mean? We're meeting in this middle ground. Right. There's these two quilts, and so that one's pretty good. This one I was very proud of, trying to make a modern version of an Amish quilt.
Huh, uh-huh.
Yeah. So,
what did you like about Amish quilts?
Well, I mean, it's very clear to me what I liked about them. Like I said, I was afraid of people, and especially my guitar player friends, and musician friends, when they heard that I was making quilts, I was deathly afraid that they would think that I was making, you know, sunbonnet Sioux
mm-hmm.
things, a little tea cozies and stuff mm-hmm. like that, you know. Well, the last thing I was ever going to do was something cute, you know, no thank you. I'm an intellectual,
uh-huh.
you know, and I don't make junk like that. Little gifts for the grandkids and stuff like that, you know. Come on. I make serious things, and there's nothing that could be more serious than a Lancaster County quilt that, you know, it's cold.
And, in a way,
design-wise, it's nothing is more colder and icy and intellectual and seeming at the time. That's how uh-huh. they were to me. That's what they represented. And so that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do something that would look intellectually detached and cold and severe mm-hmm. like that, and intellectual, you know, and minimal, yet it resembled minimal art, you
uh-huh.
know, it's so embarrassing, but that's true.
No,
that's true. And I really liked the Lancaster County stuff initially, but then that opened a doorway into the Midwestern stuff,
mm-hmm.
and then being in when the Pottinger Collection book came out and seeing all those, well, it was a revelation. And then when I got to actually see Midwestern Amish quilts, then I started having this whole series of revelations, and especially the Arthur, Illinois quilts.
Oh, I'm with you.
You know what I'm talking about?
Exactly.
That's it for me. And then when I saw, oh, you could be free. you could be free. Oh. And so there was those. And it took me a long time. Here's a copy of an Iowa Amish quilt. I've never seen the original, just a picture of it. There was a time I lost my train of thought because I saw this picture. I was trying to show you here. See, this is in here. This is the last book that we did together. And you can always tell her quilts they look playful and fun. My quilts look ice cold. That's, you know, this is what appealed to me. I wanted to copy a very difficult quilt of the past. Oh, there's this gallery section in here. Here's what we're talking about. See?
Uh-huh.
We'll take the fundamental ideas of an Amish quilt, and then we'll alter it, you know, in a more intellectual way.
Uh-huh.
You know, and where she's doing much more free stuff. This, we did these together, but this is me.
Uh-huh.
So it took me a long time to get over that. But
uh-huh.
Gradually, that's my train of thought. We did a book on applique quilts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was never my favorite thing. It really wasn't applique. It's flowers, and, you know, all of that. Well, by golly... by studying these old quilts and then copying them, then I started to feel, I started to get an appreciation
mm-hmm.
for all these different kinds of beauty and these different kinds of aesthetic realms
uh-huh.
that quilts represent. Any questions?
Any questions? What? I get to ask questions?
Yay.
So how did you make that transition from the very serious quilting?
Well, once you see, what happened to me was I met Mary Schaefer early on. Mary, one of the world's great quilt makers. Where did her aesthetic come from? Well, I could show you where it came from. Kit quilts.
Mm-hmm.
Her whole idea of how to make a quilt came from kit quilts. She studied history extensively, but what she copied was the symmetrical, was the engineered borders,
mm-hmm.
was these, you know, everything about kit quilts, the way they are engineered and designed, she learned to imitate. Down to the way she marked quilts was with a brown paper sack. She would sketch the design and then perfect it on a brown paper sack and then poke holes with a darning or with a knitting needle. Through, and then lay that on and you put pencil marks so that she had a follow the dot pattern, because that was the first quilts that she made were kit quilts and they had follow the dot patterns. Her whole aesthetic came from that. So one of my first original ideas I took over to Mary's this quilt top. I said, now I want to quilt it like this. And then on the border, here's what I'm thinking. Just bear with me. I want to put the binding on, and then just inside the binding, I want to do this little piping, just like a little an eighth of an inch edge of maybe yellow, you know, up against that red binding. Well, that's not traditional, you know. Oh yeah, I guess it's not traditional, so I guess I can't do it, you know. What it was traditional, and she was so serious about the tradition, and there was something about that appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, I won't do it then, you know, fine. It wasn't that I kept myself from doing anything original, but I don't know. But anyhow, so then a couple years later, Mary Silber showed me a quilt, dated 1863. It had a little piping around that border, that binding. A little piping around the binding. Well, what would you know about that? And I mean, I'll never forget that moment when I saw that quilt and I thought, now, wait a minute. What is Mary talking about that's traditional and what's not, and all of that? And then I really started looking at the tradition. And when you, like I say, when you look at old quilts, people think of old quilts as like this sort of mottled brown sort of things. Or something. But when you look at what's there, it's so wild and glorious, you know. And it was from really starting to collect and to study old quilts that then the ones that appealed to me were the ones that what happened was my idea of intellectual seriousness flipped.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking more like John Cage. No, you can't get any more intellectually serious than that, but also playful, you know. I started thinking of a whole different thing. I started seeing the other quilts in the. You can find whatever you want. You can go to Kansas, mid 20th century, and get Charlotte Jane Whitehill and that whole crew, Rose Kretzinger,
right,
and all of them. Well, you could get lost in that and do that for the rest of your life, you know. But what appealed to me, as a musician, and as a person, was not knowing what was going to happen next. And once I realized I could find that in quilts,
uh-huh,
that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to seek, and that's what I wanted that to do. So that's what happened. Was at first I thought quilts were valuable insofar as they resembled art. I thought my job was to make art, was to make quilts legitimate by making them artistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, my thinking changed because of what I actually saw in the tradition. When I realized that, oh, guess what? Guess what, dude? Women thought of large-scale abstract compositions with a great deal of randomness. In the mid-1800s, you can find utility quilts where she didn't know what it was going to look like. She was just sewing pieces together and cutting them freehand, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
50 years! It's a good thing I have a woman and a child in the room with me, or my language would go terrible. 50 years before the painters discovered this,
mm-hmm.
that you could make a large-scale abstract painting and not know what it was going to look like ahead of time. You could just express yourself with the paint. Women already were just expressing themselves with fabric. And they had already discovered this, and they were already doing it. So now, then, eventually what happened was I realized that this was pissing me off, that quilts still... Look at the G's Bend quilts. It's just the latest thing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I love the G's Bend quilts, but the reason that they got institutional credibility was because they resemble art. And so everybody, it's so good. It's like art. It's so good. It's a model of art.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's so condescending, number one. It's condescending to think, because the whole message here is that these uneducated women, these foolish, frivolous women stumbled into this. They actually, it turns out, they somehow accidentally made these things that we sophisticates can appreciate them for how artistic they really are. You know what I mean? It makes me want to punch somebody. It makes me so mad. So eventually I got the feeling that quilts didn't need art. Quilts exist in an aesthetic realm of their own. There's no art in a nine patch, a red and white nine patch. It's a community pattern. We all make red and white nine patches at some point in our career. Or we don't have to, but we used to.
Mm-hmm.
All women used to make a red and white nine patch at some point. You know what I mean? A green and white nine patch. Make a two-color nine patch. That's a community pattern. We're not expressing our individuality with it. We're not expressing an artistic concept that we invented. We're using all community materials. And yet, you can look at a red and white nine patch, and it can be so sublime in its proportions and in its composition
mm-hmm.
that you just float away from it. It's so beautiful. And is it art? To me, it's doing something all different than art is supposed to do. But is it an object with some form of aesthetic power? Yeah, you know. Well, so I started to have the idea that quilts don't need to be made into art. And then I see it's just the opposite. It's just the opposite is what's happening now. Now everybody thinks that in order to make quilts legitimate, to make them legitimate, we have to make them more resemble art. The more a quilt resembles a quilt, the less intellectually serious you must be. The more a quilt resembles art, the more intellectually serious you must be.
Mm-hmm.
It's that way in the quilt world today. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So if you make a quilt, don't. Just don't do it. Be creative. Express yourself. Don't make that boring nine patch. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Just don't do it. You're told don't do it. You're told don't do it because that's just what everybody does. You don't want to just do it. We're Americans. For God's sakes, we have to go our own way. We have to be mavericks.
Uh-huh.
We have to be creative. We have to be artists. And that, so, for instance, Joan Schultz uh-huh. is an artist.
Yes.
She's an artist. And she's primarily an artist. And she's working in the quilt medium. She's using quilts as a medium.
Right.
And that, I have, like, absolutely no problem with that. That's what people... who want to be artists, who want to make quilts, that's totally fine. I'm not against that at all. But what I'm against is the general feeling in the atmosphere that I just described,
mm-hmm.
that quilts that are made as art are more valuable. are more serious. This is life and death to me. You know, I'm trying to play as if my life depended on it.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? I'm serious. but I'm trying to play and have fun. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And so but I just keep coming back to all of these ideas come right straight out of the tradition. And you don't have to. God. You can do, I mean, you can find whatever you want in the tradition, but the more you know about the rest of the world, the deeper you can see into what's already there in quilts. And it doesn't bother me at all that people are using quilts as an artistic medium, but what bothers me is that the denigration of the tradition, that it's not a worthy pursuit.
Uh-huh.
I want to make it into a worthy pursuit to make traditional quilts.
Uh-huh. All right.
Of course, I haven't thought about this before.
Not at all. So you're currently doing what?
I'm currently completely abandoning all of those things I just said. No, my last hand-quilted quilt was eucalyptus leaves, and I don't have it here. It's called The Way Home. It's about where I live in the Presidio. And I feel like I finally have, I don't have to do things that look that are in using a quilt format any
mm-hmm.
longer.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like now I can make quilts. At this point in my life, I feel pretty free to make whatever I want. To do whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like this one here, it's called My Own Fault. And it's about living in San Francisco. And when I'm done quilting it, it'll be a quilt. You know, big enough to sleep under.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I really know about it. And at this point, it feels to me like not doing community patterns. That's what I feel like not doing. I feel like I just want to make my own stuff for a while and see where it goes.
Uh-huh.
So, that's what I'm doing now.
That sounds good. Well, I think we are running to the end of our time together today.
Right.
I really look forward to continuing our conversation in
the
future.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
So thank you so much. It's now 2:49 on August 18, and this is Yannikin Smucker signing off with Joe Cunningham for Quilters SOS. Thank you so much, Joe.
You're welcome.